The IRGC top commander urges Europe not to repeat its mistakes after the European Parliament called for designating the Iranian military organization as a terrorist entity. The World Court says it has received the UN request to give an advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation of Palestinian land. And an Israeli settler kills a Palestinian man near the occupied West Bank city of Ramallah over an alleged knife attack. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, has warned Europe against moving forward with a resolution that calls for blacklisting the military organization as a terrorist entity. IRGC top commander Major General Hossein Salami urged European countries not to repeat their mistakes. He added that Iran is not concerned about such threats, even if they are carried out. Salami said that the IRGC is a powerful force and will act accordingly. On Thursday, the European Parliament passed a resolution calling for designating the IRGC as a terror group. Iranian Foreign Ministry, or Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, slammed the resolution, saying that it runs counter to the UN Charter. He added that the IRGC played a constructive role in the fight against Daesh in Iraq and in Syria and stopped the terror group's attacks in European capitals. Iranian lawmakers have introduced a motion that would blacklist armed forces of EU countries as terrorist entities if Europe implements its resolution. We were earlier joined by journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas. He explains why the West continues to take more anti-Iran measures.
I haven't seen the British establishment starting to throw the toys out of the pram quite as robustly as they're doing at the moment. They seem to be very, very irritated at the failure, the latest failure of their regime change efforts. They seem to be taking it out on a lot of the Islamic centers or the centers linked to the Iran over here as well. So we're feeling the pressure even here. They have their pro-riot groups across the world who are all mobilized and remain mobilized, and they're supporting them in every way, shape, and form as well. But what they're really upset about is that the IRGC consistently has successfully countered terrorism in the West Asian region. And as Mr. Ghani says, it's absolutely the case that all of that terrorism, and all, I mean all of that terrorism in West Asia, all of it can be taken back to either Whitehall or to the gates of Tel Aviv or the gateways of Washington. This is just a plain and open fact. There is no doubting anybody who's worth anything in politics knows this to be the case.
Top UN court says it has officially received the request from the General Assembly to give an opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territories. The International Court of Justice confirmed the request in a press release without specifying a timeline. Last month, the UN General Assembly resolution asked the court to give advice on a number of Israeli measures. They include the regime's settlement and annexation, as well as altering the demography and the status of the city of Al-Quds. The resolution was supported by 98 countries against 17 no votes and 52 abstentions. Palestinians hailed it as a diplomatic and legal breakthrough, but Israel called it a despicable move. The Hague-based court's ruling are binding, but it lacks power to enforce them. In 2004, the ICJ also ruled that the Israeli separation wall in the occupied territories was illegal. Palestinian scientist and author Mazin Khumsaya says that Israel and its main backer, the U.S., are not going to adhere to any international ruling on the occupied Palestinian territories.
It's a balance of power that determines when people get their freedom. So it's a struggle that determines, not international systems. International systems can help by shedding the light on the justice of the cause, and that's what will happen with this international ruling, that it sheds a light on the illegality of the Israeli occupation. But ultimately, Israel and the United States are not going to listen to international law, and it has to be implemented against their will, basically. So you have to have force to achieve justice. The wall continues to be built 19 years after a ruling that says it's illegal. Actually, most of it was built since 2004. The refugees, there was international rulings about the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands in 1949. And here we are, many, many decades later, the right of return has not been implemented. So again, it's rulings, international justice and laws do not mean much if the local people don't get the power to change the circumstances.
Another Palestinian falls victim to Israeli violence in the occupied West Bank, bringing the total deaths this year to 18. The Israeli military says a Palestinian man was shot dead by a settler at a farm near the city of Ramallah. It says the Palestinian was trying to stab an Israeli man. No one was wounded in the incident. Tensions have remained high in the occupied territories in the past months as Israel has stepped up its crackdown against Palestinians. In response, the Palestinians have conducted a series of attacks against Israelis. Resistance movements have backed the attacks, saying they are a natural response to the Israeli atrocities. Foreign Ministry of Yemen's National Salvation Government has condemned the British government over its hostilities against the Yemeni people. The ministry says that Britain is behind an ongoing economic war against the Yemenis, which includes a range of policies. It says part of those policies focuses on raising the price of the dollar. A correspondent in Sana'a explains how that policy, also backed by the U.S., affects the lives of the Yemenis.
This is an economic move, as I mentioned, that's you know, this is where government officials, they store a lot of U.S. dollars. They take it out of the economic flow in Yemen, and they store a massive amount of U.S. dollars. And they do this so that the U.S. dollar exchange rate can increase, and then once the exchange rate increases by 50%, as is the case in this situation, they cash in, and they make millions and millions of dollars of profit. And this, unfortunately, is coming at the cost of the innocent civilians living in the areas under the control of the Yemeni government backed by Saudi Arabia. What this move is, the U.S. and the British government are basically supporting a move that's going to increase prices across the board in the areas controlled by the Saudi-backed government.
The United States is covertly sponsoring the Daesh terror group in Afghanistan after Washington withdrew from the country in August 2021. That is according to Russia's presidential envoy for Afghanistan, Zamir Kubalov. The official has made the comment in an interview with Russia 24 TV. He said the U.S. has been reaching out to armed groups opposed to the Taliban and secretly giving money to Daesh. Kubalov said that Washington has been acting this way to avenge what he called its shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan. He says the U.S. does everything to prevent peace in that troubled land. And the Russian official says the U.S. aims to undermine the stability of his country as well. The Taliban took over Afghanistan after the U.S. ended two decades of war and military presence there.
Zamir Kubalov, Russia's presidential envoy to Afghanistan, says that the U.S. has been reaching out to the Taliban's opposition groups, such as Daesh, and secretly giving money to them. He describes the reasoning for this covert support as such: because they really want to avenge their shameful military political defeat in Afghanistan, and in retaliation, they do everything so that peace isn't established in this troubled land. He further linked this move to Russia's security by saying, "With the armed opposition in Afghanistan, the Anglo-Saxons are covertly sponsoring Daesh, who are aimed at undermining not only the stability of our Central Asian partners, but also the security of Russia." Allegations of the U.S. supporting Daesh in particular have been around for a decade at this point. Sometimes they even come from U.S. officials.
ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be Crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, Crooked Hillary Clinton.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is among the top officials that accused the United States of backing Daesh. Erdogan made the accusations in response to U.S. accusations against his government for supporting terrorist groups. He said, "Now they give support to terrorist groups including Daesh, YPG, PYD. It is very clear. We have confirmed evidence with pictures, photos, and videos." In a 3-year field study into the supply chain of Daesh, it was found that the arming and external funding that anti-Assad rebel groups received from the U.S. found their way into the hands of Daesh. With all the accusations on America's direct involvement in the founding of Daesh, the indirect involvement that most of the world agrees resulted in the creation of the terror group is the quote-unquote power vacuum that the U.S. left in the region by fighting the many wars it fought, especially the invasion of Iraq and the support of Syrian rebel groups.
The U.S.'s chaotic pullout from Afghanistan could have been the pretext for a power grab by Daesh. But that did not happen, as the Taliban took over Afghanistan. Back in 21, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan to topple the Taliban regime.
The U.S. effectively fought a war in Afghanistan for 20 years with a budget of over $2.1 trillion to replace the Taliban with the Taliban. The Taliban has been accused of many things since their swift power grab back in August of 2021, but what they have managed to do is stabilizing the country and ridding it of power struggles. That means groups like Daesh, who still have a presence in the region, weren't able to establish bases in Afghanistan, despite still carrying out terrorist attacks for a while after Taliban's takeover, the number of which have significantly dropped over the last year. Now, with around 97% of the population of Afghanistan below poverty line, and with half of the country's billions of dollars worth of foreign assets frozen by the U.S., the last thing the country can afford is U.S. shenanigans trying to prop up Takfiri terrorist groups there. Recently, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken poured salt on the wounds of Afghanistan by justifying the way the U.S. left Afghanistan by saying, if the forces had remained there, quote, it would have, I think, made much more complicated the support that we've been able to give and that others have been able to give Ukraine. Almost as if Afghanistan was a pawn in the grand scheme of U.S.'s political agendas, an attitude that isn't too uncommon in U.S. politics with all of their friends and foes. Instances of such attitude are numerous. From the promise of retaliation to Saudi Arabia over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and then doing nothing about it because Saudi Arabia is a strategic partner to the U.S., to using Taiwan as a means to get under China's skin that could lead to a conflict wherein Taiwan will turn into a pawn for U.S.'s political games.
The NATO chief called on Ukraine's military sponsors to focus on sending new weapons, in addition to planning on supplying ammunition for older systems.
Battle tanks are important, as are all the other systems. And in addition to new platforms, we need also to remember that we need to not only focus on new platforms, but also to ensure that all the platforms which are already there can function as they should, meaning that we need ammunition, we need spare parts, we need maintenance, and we need training.
Stoltenberg made the remarks on the sidelines of a NATO summit in Germany. The meeting was convened to discuss whether to send modern battle tanks to Kiev. Poland's defense minister said no decision on supplying Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine had been reached at the meeting. In recent days, German officials have said that they will not send advanced tanks to Ukraine and will not allow any other country with the German-made tanks to send them either. German defense minister says Berlin is not alone in preventing the delivery. Boris Pistorius says the German government is still weighing the pros and cons of the matter. Washington declared a $2.5 billion military aid package for Ukraine ahead of the NATO meeting. The EU plans to deport a record number of asylum seekers in 2023, deemed to be illegal immigrants, while applying no limits on the number of Ukrainian refugees who wish to enter the 27-country bloc. Rights groups insist that the EU has a legal responsibility to treat all refugees equally, regardless of their ethnicity. Jerome Hughes has more from Brussels.
Already in 2023, 30 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they attempted to reach the EU, according to figures from the United Nations. The EU's border and coast guard agency, Frontex, has in the past been lambasted for pushing back unsafe boats, resulting in deaths. On Thursday, the new head of the agency vowed to end this practice.
I am responsible for the fact that my people don't participate in anything called a pushback. So I think that that is absolutely clear. That is the legal framework I work in. So that's it.
According to OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 and 2021 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex. The agency prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. In just 10 months, the EU has welcomed more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees. They are afforded all the same rights as EU citizens. However, if you're from a different part of the world, torn up by Western powers, it's a different story. We visited a shelter for Afghans in Brussels.
Before we come in the Europe, we think the Europe care about women, care about children. Now we come in here, not. They don't care about women, they don't care about children.
When the children go to school, they need food, they need clothes. And for everything, we need to work. So we need the job permit.
There are no such problems for Ukrainians. Of course, that's to be welcomed, but rights groups are asking why the discrimination. EU Home Affairs ministers will meet in Stockholm, Sweden next Thursday to agree on a more effective strategy to deport asylum seekers who don't meet refugee status criteria. Campaigners point out there are no plans to adopt a similar policy for refugees arriving here from Western Ukraine, arguably a relatively safe region. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight.
A new poll shows that half of citizens in 9 EU nations want a quick end to Ukraine-Russia crisis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT reported in this regard, roughly half of the people in nine EU nations favor a swift end to the armed conflict in Ukraine, even if it means Kiev would have to relinquish its claims on some of its former territory. A new opinion poll has shown. The survey was conducted in Austria, France, Germany, Greece, Italy, the Netherlands, Poland, Portugal, and Spain. The results were reported recently by Euroscopia, an alliance of polling agencies based in those countries. Some 48% of all respondents said they favored a quick resolution to the conflict, even if it meant Ukraine had to lose land to achieve that goal. Only 32% opposed the idea of Kiev making sacrifices. Ukrainian officials pledged to fight until their forces seize control of all the territory the country considers its own, and EU leaders have vowed to help as long as it takes. The EU public's skepticism was particularly profound in Austria and Germany, where 64% and 60% of those surveyed, respectively, favored a shortcut to peace. Euroscopia noted that this perspective clashed with the official stance of the German government, which has been among the most generous supporters in the EU in terms of military aid to Kiev. Respondents in the Netherlands, 27%, and Poland, 28%, were the least supportive of making compromises to achieve peace, the poll indicated. A majority of people in nine EU nations, that is 56%, want to continue shipping arms to Ukraine, but there was a dissenting minority. In Greece and Italy, 60% and 50% of survey participants opposed the military assistance to Ukraine, while 38% in each country said they approved of it. Greeks and Italians are also among the least supportive of the sanctions imposed by the EU on Russia, according to the poll. While over 51% of all people polled favored the restrictions, the share of Greeks and Italians backing the policy was just 29% and 38% respectively. In Austria, 38% of respondents approved the sanctions. The website of Euractiv also noted 50% of surveyed Spaniards think that the Russia-Ukraine conflict should end as soon as possible, even if this means Ukrainians would have to sacrifice some territory and make concessions to Moscow, a new pan-European survey shows. The study was carried out by the European Opinion Polling Network in nine EU countries, including Portugal, Austria, the Netherlands, Poland, Spain, France, Germany, Italy, and Greece. Euractiv's partner EFE reports. In Spain, the study was carried out by Sigma Das at the end of December based on interviews with 1,000 people. The study revealed that voters of the left-wing ruling coalition parties are the ones most in favor of an early end to the crisis, even if it means territorial concessions. Both 61% of left-wing Unidas Podemos voters and 55% of center-left PSOE voters put peace before a complete victory for Ukraine with the help of the Western allies. About 46% of center-right Partido Popular voters agree, as do 45% of far-right Vox voters and 44% of central-liberal citizens voters. However, 38% of PP voters disagree, as do 36% of Vox voters and 41% of CS voters. With regard to Madrid's military support for the Ukrainians, 61% of Spaniards are in favor, an issue which significantly divides voters of different political camps. PSOE voters and PP voters agree with more than 60%, while more than half of Unidas Podemos voters reject any extension of Spanish military support to Kiev. Similarly, Unidas Podemos voters stand out from the rest when asked whether the EU should buy gas from Russia again if the conflict in Ukraine ends with an agreement which is rejected by one of every two Spaniards. However, 41.4% of Unidas Podemos voters would negotiate with Russian President Vladimir Putin, but among PSOV voters, only 32% would consider doing so. Euroscopia survey also revealed that important differences are emerging among Europeans regarding managing the war in Ukraine. In all the EU countries surveyed, 48% are in favor of a quick end to military help to Kiev. Austria with 64% support for a quick end of the crisis, and Germany with 60% are the member states with the highest support for that option.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. The issue of human rights is one of the most fundamental human issue, and there is no argument about that. And at the same time, it is one of the most sensitive and controversial as well. Because when we look at human rights, we always seem to see it from our perspective. Now, I, as a human being, and you, as a human being, want to enjoy all your basic human rights. But sometimes when it comes to other people, we seem to say, well, they don't deserve it. Oh, they don't deserve to live. They don't deserve to have this. They don't deserve to have that. And becomes very sensitive and controversial. Should all human beings enjoy it, or is it limited to a specific group of people? Now, during recent decades, this problem, the problem or the issue of human rights, it was more of a political issue rather than ethical or legal. So as we see now, starting from the last two decades or maybe a little bit more, but, you know, to be specific, even to the last decade, when the whole world started this industrial revolution and the world became kind of one village from, you know, the inventions of radios and TVs and what have you. So people started to become closer. So it was, this issue was turned into a political issue rather than an ethical or, legal issue. Although the influence of politics or political motives are considerations of how we made this issue and this topic more complicated and very hard to at least apply rather than grasp. So in the Western thought, the issue of human rights was raised by thinkers of the at least post-Renaissance period. It is only since the last 200 years or so that it became an issue of prominence among the political and social issue of the Western society. So it is a new concept, a fairly new born concept to the Westerners or to the Western world when philosophers and thinkers started to, you know, dive in more into this issue. But when we examine the causes of many social changes and political upheavals, we find that the marks of its presence and its principal ideals. So during the last decades, this emphasis reached its climax in the West. And then we have the especially with the formation of the United Nations after the Second World War, and subsequently a drafting what we call the Charter or the Declaration of Human Rights Charter, where they laid the laws and rules and the morals to how human beings should treat one another or what rights they should enjoy. So it wasn't very long when this charter was announced and the United Nations were trying to force the countries under their wing to apply it. So within the last two decades, this concept was brought forward. How was it in Islam, though? Is it also the same? Is it recent or is it old? And how does Islam look at this issue? Let us take a break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So just before the break, we were saying that the Western world itself, the concept of human rights, was introduced to it within the last two decades. So it's fairly a new concept of idea. And they're still in the work, they're still working on it, trying to perfect it, but apparently it's not happening. They're not doing it very well because it is politically motivated rather than ethically motivated. As Muslims, though, we Muslims, of course, know it very well that if the West world and the Western civilization had paid attention to this matter in the recent centuries, Islam has dealt with it from various aspects many centuries back. I mean, if the West just opened their eyes to the concept of human rights, we as Muslims, this concept of human rights started centuries back. It started with Islam itself. When Islam came, it came with every aspect of a human rights that people might indulge with. The idea of human rights as a fundamental principle can be seen to underline throughout Islamic teachings. And this does not need any elaboration for any Muslim audience. As Muslims, our practice, our daily practice with one another and with our fellow human beings revolves around the issue of human rights. So I have been taught Islamically by the Quran and by the words of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam and the household that I need to respect my fellow human beings. I need to treat them fairly and I need to treat them with respect. And even if we take the classical hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam that he says, love for others that which you love for yourself, is basically the foundation of human rights. As much as I like to enjoy free will, life, education, safety, security, and the list goes on. As much as I like to enjoy them, then I should love it for someone else to enjoy. So I can't say, well, no, I'm the elite, I'm superior to other beings, so I should enjoy these rights and I don't care about other people, or other people should not get it. That is not an Islamic ideal. So all Muslims, from the beginning, they had their own charter of human rights embedded in their teachings, in their life, in their work, and everything they do. Rather, if we look at it from a Western perspective, it's a very new concept. To this day, we are still seeing people suffer, even within the civilization or countries that they claim to be, you know, human rights champions. Look at the States, United States, for example. You will see until today, you know, people of color, they're having issue in the country. People of different ethnicities, they're still having issues. People with certain faiths, they're still having issues. They've been prosecuted, they've been suffering. There's a lot of restrictions on them. They, you know, and we created phobias for them, like, for example, Islamophobia, and so on and so forth. So you can begin to say that there is no human rights being applied when the people. It might be written on a charter somewhere, but on the ground, it does not exist in the Western civilization. Where Muslims, it is their daily practice. And that's what makes Islam more superior to any system that man has made. We'll leave it here, inshallah, and we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The people of the impoverished Arab country of Yemen, which have been under a years-long Saudi blockade and Western-supported war, are suffering more than ever due to lack of medicine and food. Yemen has recently warned about a human catastrophe as 5,000 kidney patients face death over Saudi blockade. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV recently reported Yemen's Ministry of Health has warned of a human catastrophe that threatens the lives of more than 5,000 patients with renal failure as a result of the years-long Saudi blockade and war against the impoverished Arab country. Ali Jahaf, National Salvation Government's Deputy Health Minister, made the remark at a press conference in the capital, Sana'a, as he raised the alarm about the depletion of the stock of dialysis drugs and medicine for Yemeni patients suffering from chronic kidney disease. "This is not the first conference, and we have held more than one. We have been warning of a human catastrophe threatening the lives of thousands of dialysis patients in various governorates, but there is no response," Jahaf was quoted as saying by Yemen's Ansarullah news website. He added, "We have addressed the United Nations and health organizations operating in Yemen that we need to provide sufficient drug stocks for dialysis sessions for the year 2023, as we need approximately 500,000 dialysis sessions every year without receiving a response, despite lots of correspondence and meetings in this regard." Stressing that dialysis centers in Yemen are standing on the verge of stopping, Jahaf said the issue will affect the lives of 5,000 patients with kidney failure who need dialysis sessions and drugs, and they may lose their lives if these solutions and medicine are not available urgently. The deputy health minister underscored the importance of opening Sana'a Airport and the port of Hudaydah, as they are vital outlets for medicine and food for millions of Yemenis in the besieged areas by the Saudi-led coalition aggression, adding, "In light of the imposed blockade, we are unable as a country to import vital medicine and save our patients." Jahaf went on to say that we are in urgent need within 2 weeks to provide dialysis sessions, and our stock has run out. Anis Al-Asbahi, spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health, also called on international organizations to urgently provide dialysis sessions so that dialysis centers would continue to operate and save the lives of Yemeni patients. Asbahi held the United Nations responsible for saving the lives of dialysis patients and responding to the basic requirements of the Yemeni people under the siege, stressing the need to open Sana'a Airport and Hudaydah Port. Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies, with arms and logistics support from the US and other Western states, launched the devastating war on Yemen in March 2015. The objective was to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of a functional government in Yemen, and reinstall the Riyadh-friendly regime of Abd Rabbo Mansur Hadi. While the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve any of its objectives, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and spawned the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, Xinhua reported for Islam Fuad, an eye doctor at a public hospital in northern Yemen, the most difficult part of his job is to tell his patients that they have to find treatment elsewhere while knowing most of them will never be able to afford it. At the Al-Jada Health Center in Miri District, Hajjah Province, eye patients from over 20 nearby villages come over for help, but only a few could receive treatment. The doctor told Xinhua after just advising a mother to take her four-year-old boy to other cities for treatment. While the number of eye patients is increasing day by day, the center lacks the equipment and specialist physician to treat eye diseases because of the blockade imposed on us. The mother Aisha Al-Hadri said her child Abdullah lost his eyesight 2 weeks after his head was hit by a small stone while playing with his brothers. Hadri told Xinhua, "The doctor told me to take him to specialized hospitals for diagnosis and treatment in other cities or provinces due to the lack of medical equipment here because of the Saudi blockade. The roads have been cut and we cannot go to other provinces, and even if we can, I don't know if we can afford such a trip," the mother said, adding she was afraid that the delay of treatment may cause Abdullah to lose eyesight permanently. The health center is one of the few public clinics that are still operating in Northern Coastal District, as most of the health facilities were destroyed during the Saudi blockade and battles against Yemeni people. The public hospitals in Yemen are severely ill-funded across the war-ravaged country, and most Yemenis who live in abject poverty can never afford the medical bills at private clinics.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful question, a very interesting question. Today on The Key, the question we're going to be asking is about what are the effects of sin? You know, we know that, you know, in the hereafter, the effect of sin, a sin that we do not repent from, obviously, with the condition that God does not forgive us for it, is that, you know, we become punished for it. But what are the effects of the sins that we commit in this world? Are there any effects of it? Yes, there are. Fortunately, these have been alluded to in the hadith. For example, we have a hadith from Imam Baqir, whose birthday it is today, in which the Imam alayhi salam says, when the rainfall is less from year to year, for example, 1 year the rainfall is a lot, the next year it becomes a little bit less than that, next year it becomes less than that. The Imam says, if this happens, this occurs, it is only because Allah sends it down as and when He wishes, such that when people commit acts of disobedience to Him, Allah, mighty and exalted, withholds the rain that He had ordained from them. Meaning, the more people commit sins, you know, the more, the less the rain becomes, and you know, the rainfall becomes increasingly less. This is one of the, and this has an effect on, obviously, the produce, and, you know, the water available to them, and so on and so forth. All of these things are connected to one another. In another hadith, we read the following from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, his son. When a man commits a sin, a black spot appears on his heart. If he repents, it is effaced. But if he continues committing it, the spot increases and grows until it engulfs the whole heart, and he can never prosper. He can never again prosper, spiritually prosper. You know, and Imam Sadiq also said, Allah never bestows bounties on His servant, only to take them away again until and unless he commits a sin, whereby he becomes deserving of Allah's deprivation. God taketh and God taketh away. So when we commit, but His granting of a bounty or His taking away of that bounty it's never haphazard. The believers in God's justice believe that God's will is not haphazard. It isn't haphazardly, intend something. Rather, his intentions, the decisions he makes, all of them are based on maslahat, and what is expedient and what is beneficial for his servant. And one of the things that has an effect on his intention. That's an improper way of wording, what we want to say here. One of the things that leads to, the deprivation spiritually and also worldly is the sins that we commit. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the effects of sins. Once again, thank you for joining us here. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful and noble hadith which has been transmitted from Imam Ali alayhi salam. This hadith is about God's love towards His servant. There are numerous verses in the Holy Quran regarding God's love for His creatures. And, of course, it's necessary to remember that God has two types of love, right? There is a general love and affection and mercy, right, which encompasses all of God's creatures, regardless of whether they are good or bad. And at the same time, God has a specific love. This is specifically for those servants who are righteous and good. Right? And in this hadith, Allah's love for His creatures, the love that is being referred to is the specific love. Right? This love is acquired by means of good deeds and by means of servanthood and ibadat. In the Holy Quran, we read the following regarding God's love. Say, if you love Allah, then follow me. Allah will love you and forgive your sins. The criterion for the acquisition of God's love in this beautiful verse of the Holy Quran is the emulation of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, because he is the Habib, the beloved of God, and if we want to become beloved like him, we want God to love us like he loved his beloved prophet, then we should emulate him and act like he did and follow him in his actions and his mannerisms and his beliefs and his thoughts. And this verse is interesting because it says that, you know,